Hey, you, Robert? Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. Lately, I've been doing a lot of reading on Amerindian religion, North and South America, and particularly anthropological accounts of shamanism and the worlds that such masters of the forest inhabit. And, you know, I'll be honest, like, I know a lot of people are very interested in shamanism these days, and there is quite a sense of urgency and hope around the use of some shamanic substances, ayahuasca, and the sort of worldview that emerges from that. And while I'm very interested in these models, I sometimes find myself, when I'm reading through the more enthusiastic literature, a bit challenged by what I often see as an excessive romanticism about the worldview of the folks in the jungle. And along with that, an overly simplistic kind of attack on the West, which is, needless to say, deeply troubled situation that nobody needs to be reminded of. But that doesn't necessarily mean the thing to do is to create another a belief of an entirely separate kind of indigenous world of wonder in contrast to the hell that we inhabit as Cartesian, Western, disenchanted people. I just think things are a little more complicated than that. What I've discovered, though, is the more reading I do and the more I look at anthropologists as well as first-person accounts and accounts of individuals working in these situations, that things get a lot richer. There's a lot more interchange. And so really what I've kind of gone through a little sea change in my own thought of really trying to account for these things, understand them, talk to people, gain a different perspective, but really motivated by a sense that there really are some fundamental differences, and that these differences are incredibly important to articulate, and at the same time to prevent the tendency to romanticize the other and to overly castigate our own particular heritage, despite its inevitable problems. One concept that has really stuck with me, that's a real fun one to play with, is this idea, and I think it's really true, that for most Westerners, deep down, there's this very basic belief, which we hold even if we're not necessarily conscious of, just because of the culture that we've been raised in. And the belief is the following, that out there, there's nature. And nature is one thing. It's just like, it's just this machine of causes. It's just objective reality, one cause leading to another. And it's this natural object that is outside of us. And then on the inside, we have culture. We have human beings telling stories, projecting dreams and fears, weaving together new creations of culture. And that what happens then is that people project their different views, their different cultural views, onto the one nature. So it's basically that there's one nature that's ruled by natural law, and then multiple cultures, multiculturalism, relativism, where everybody sees this one nature in different ways. What we see in the shamanic worldview, in the animist worldview, is probably even a better way to talk about it, is a fundamentally different idea. There is no nature as such. There are animals, plants, weather systems, the forest, but they all have a character of animation, a relational character, a possibility of entering into a dialogue. There's no such thing as some objective, flat thing ruled by natural law upon which we project ideas. So when Westerners look at shamans and go, oh, they're just projecting cultural ideas onto animals, It's not even that that's incorrect. It's that the fundamental worldview of the Westerner is not being called into question by this more relational, embodied, imaginal, networked way of being in the world. So anyway, I'm super jazzed about that, and that's why I'm jazzed that we are talking today to Robert Tyndall, I hope is how you pronounce it. He's the author of the new book, The Shamanic Odyssey, Homer, Tolkien, and the Visionary Experience. It's a great book, really fun to read, and probably why I like it is because it does precisely what I was suggesting at the beginning, which is while it sees the problems with the Western view and sees the tremendous healing and wisdom in the ways of the forest, both in the Amazon, with which he's most familiar, but in other indigenous traditions, that he also finds traces of these things within Western culture. And it goes into Tolkien, goes into the Odyssey, to Homer, to find overlaps, parallels, rich connections that begin to break down this rigid distinction between Western and indigenous ways of looking at the world. So it's a great book. I'm really happy to have Robert on the show. But before we bring him on, our co-host here, Maja Daou. Maja, how's it going?
It's going good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Someone stole your computer?
Yeah, in a good metaphor for the conversation, whether or not you believe that natural cultures are inherent in the world and exist inside of ourselves and outside of ourselves, you see it repeated in everything. You know, the way things get stolen or kind of appropriated or nature will take over our own, that we set up all these civilizations with cultures and rules. And, you know, things like we think this is going to work this way and that'll work that way. But eventually, you know, coyote will find his way into our neat and tidy little cultural experiences. And coyote will jack up our arrogant ideas of how we think we're so high and mighty. So, yes, having my computer stolen was a good example of how coyote sneaks in everywhere.
Yeah, you cannot keep that guy down. So with that, let's bring on Robert to the show. Robert, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to join you.
Yeah, that's great. So why don't you tell me where you're calling from? It seems like a very interesting place.
We are presently living in Peru, in the mestizo culture down here, a very noisy, polluted, roaring town called Tarapoto, which is surrounded by rainforest. And my wife and I are working at a center called Takawasi, which has been treating addicts to heroin, cocaine, crack, etc., quite successfully with a combination of Western medicine and the real shamanic traditions of the rainforest. They bring in shamans from different groups to work with the clients here. And there's a very interesting exploration of the therapeutic potentials of the medicinal plants and shamanic traditions going on here, which is it's pretty unique. And
yeah,
like my co-author and wife, Susanna, is doing research here into the, particularly into the diets that are done here with medicinal plants.
In terms of the way in which particular diets contribute to addicts being able to shift their situation?
Well, diets in the Vejitalista tradition involve going into the monte, up into the mountain, and drinking particular plants that are known to have particular kind of initiatory psychological effects. And these can be, for example, I've dieted shiwawako. They use the coca leaf here. There's particular plants like the chitiksinango and others that have been found to be particularly effective with the issues that addicts face.
That's wonderful.
So,
things I like the most about your book, there are a lot of fascinating chapters, but I think the one on addiction really stood out for me, partly because you're clearly talking, you know, from experience of someone who's been around and addicts as they've gone through this who have watched these processes and watched these plants, but also in the way in which you characterize different relationships to plants and to psychoactive experiences that people have. I mean, in some sense, there's a continuum between these unhealthy relationships with plants, tobacco or poppy, and more healthy and eye-opening versions. And it's a really important distinction to be made given the rhetoric of the drug war. And it also has a really strong, you know, spiritual dimension that you work through in a really interesting way in the book. So why don't you tell me a little bit more about how you see the dynamics of addiction from the perspective of this shamanic potential for a deeper connection to nature and spirit?
The premise here at Takawasi is addiction is a thwarted or unconscious spiritual quest for that intimacy with the cosmos that we all need. And the of course, you know, the classic image in the Odyssey of addiction are the sirens. And this is a recurring motif throughout ancient literature. And, of course, the sirens are those singers that transfix mariners out in the ocean and catch them in a song that promises to fulfill their every desire. And the mariners will leap off the ship and swim without any control toward the shore, and then they'll just wither up and die, wrapped in the siren song. And on the shore, you can see their bodies littered about, skeletons and in various stages of decomposition. It's a very intense image. And Odysseus chooses to listen to that song, which for me was fascinating because, as you pointed out with the drug war and the kind of puritanical mindset behind it, there's a rhetoric of fear and distrust, not just of addiction, but of, you could call it altered states, symbiotic consciousness, whatever. And, what you learn at Takawasi, is that that experience of another intelligence, of a sentience that is woven through nature and creation, is when in a ritual setting and properly handled, you know, with centuries and centuries of experience, can be deeply healing and liberating for people. Measurably so. I mean, addicts that go through treatment at Takawasi relapse much less than in programs in the United States. That's just statistically proven. And, you know, we also document a major healing of a disease that Western science simply couldn't do with the same kind of animistic methods that are traditional to shamanic cultures.
So here's a question just in terms of the Odyssey. So why does Odysseus want to hear the siren call? Is it just, is he curious, or is there some deeper dimension in the story?
Yeah. There are a number of points in the Odyssey that, after my being immersed in the Vehitalista tradition long enough, really began to change their meaning for me. And one of those is the siren song. People tend to avoid that question. Like if you look through the commentary in the classical literature, no one really wants to talk about it. But if you look at the process of shamanic initiation and consider what it means to be able to go in and hear a particular song or relate to a particular entity and establish a kind of relationship with them through that, and then to come back out again, and be able to, there's a kind of, in the shamanic tradition and the stories about it as well. You know, I don't want to conflate those two, but in both of them, there's a tradition of entering into unknown terrain and hearing songs, especially, through which the consciousness of other beings becomes manifest. And possibly receiving a song yourself as a consequence. But at any rate, you know, coming through being changed, mutated, transformed, whatever. And then you have something in your repertoire that you can continue on with. And throughout the Odyssey, Odysseus's approach to more powerful being situations that are new to him, you see him constantly accumulating knowledge. But it's not just bookish learning. It's direct experiential knowledge that adds to his, you'd say, like spiritual virtue, his ability to negotiate with spirits and to get home and to set things right in Ithaca.
Well, one of the interesting
things about... So there's very, like, concrete human outcomes he's after here as well.
Yeah, yeah. But one of the things about your portrayal of Odysseus that strikes me is it makes it so worthwhile to go back and look at that, and I'm actually going to be rereading that text. Even before I got your book, I had a plan, is the way in which he's such a bridge figure. Because on the one hand, he clearly is embedded in this shamanic worldview, and he's relating with all of these other characters and other situations, which are explicitly in the vein that you're talking about. And you're I think very evident that the relationship with Kierke and with going to Hades and the, you know, meeting Hermes and getting the Molly plant. I mean, there's all of this plant lore, all of this sort of pacts and other worlds and magical songs, et cetera, but at the same time, and for good reason, Odysseus has been seen as this sort of figure of the break, of the emergence of the modern individual, the crafty, canny entrepreneur, the conquistador, you call him in the books, but he's a fusion of the two. It's not like a 100% rupture. It's like he's got one foot in both worlds, which makes him really interesting for us to look at in the West as a kind of character, both of like what was before, where we're going, what the implications are. So tell a little bit more about this figure of Odysseus who runs through your story and how you see him as a way for us to think about our own potential to have more indigenous minds, and yet we still have to deal with the whole consequence of our Western civilization, quote-unquote, heritage. So tell me more about Odysseus as you see him.
Well, I think you hit it on the head earlier, you know, that fine line between romanticism and cynicism, you know, how do you walk the middle way? And we are now all people that have to be culturally ambidextrous. But that doesn't mean we have to be stupid. And Odysseus is not stupid. this is, I think, the thing that has so attracted people to him throughout the years. And he's a deeply flawed character. I mean, you know, he's a mercenary pirate who murders and rapes and, you know, attacks people. And there's nothing very attractive about Odysseus on the surface. And yet, there's something profoundly attractive about his commitment to get back home, to get out of the other world, and his ability to negotiate his way back with all of his cunning and courage. And so he speaks to something deeply archetypal in us in that way. And I do think that he is an incredibly rich object lesson in the emergence of the individual self in the West. Because, like you're saying, he's right at that edge. His technique is what distinguishes him when he fights the Cyclops. Now, Let me talk about the Cyclops for just a minute here, because there were certain things that when I came back from the Amazon and I began teaching the Odyssey that leapt out at me from the text. And one of them was the clash between Polyphemus, the Cyclops, and Odysseus, which most people know. You know, Odysseus goes and raids his cave. The Cyclops comes back. He's the size of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Everyone scurries into the corner. Then they end up blinding him after getting him drunk, escape from the cave, rustling is heard. And then Odysseus curses him from offshore, and Polyphemus returns to favor and traps Odysseus within his father Poseidon's oceanic realm. Now, this is a very old story. It's far older than Homer. It's got very deep resonances. So Walter Burkert long ago pointed out the master of animals figure, which appears in the Cyclops story, and I point out in the book also occurs in other places. But there's a particular exchange that goes back and forth between the Cyclops and Odysseus when Odysseus has put offshore enough that he dares to taunt the now blinded Cyclops. And this is the section that I had always read in the traditional way, and after being long enough within the Vegetalista tradition and working with ayahuasca and the other plants down here in the south, and also in the Native American church up in the north, and learning the Hopi prophecy and being involved in the tradition of the Teoteros, which is also incredibly rich, my view shifted. And what happens in the exchange between the two is the Odysseus reveals who he is. Up till then, the Cyclops, actually stunned by the super potent wine that Odysseus brought in, thought that Odysseus' name was Nobody. And when Odysseus reveals his name, a whole prophecy comes back to the Cyclops, and he realizes that he'd been told that he was going to be blinded by a certain Odysseus. And when he realizes that, the Cyclops seems to go through a complete shift in attitude, and he uses the Greek language for host and guest exchange and offers to bless his journey. And in exchange for doing that, if they do that, it opens the way for Poseidon to heal his eye. Now, this isn't stated explicitly in the text, but in these ancient texts, because of the style they're written in, things aren't always made explicit. And we also have to remember that Homer is inheriting a tradition much older than his own, and so it may have drifted some. But I think you see the lineaments there of a attempt to bury the hatchet, to make peace with what has happened. The Cyclops is genuinely offering to bless Odysseus' journey home, and at the same time saying, you can heal me. Now, the traditional reading of the Cyclops dismisses him and states that basically the Cyclops is going to knock out Odysseus' brains when he comes to shore, and it's a transparent ploy. But if you see Odysseus as this emerging figure, this new individual who's coming out in the world with his trickery and his new technique, it's very dangerous. This guy's going to end up, like, inventing nuclear weapons. And if we see that the Cyclops, as in the old story tradition representing indigenous people, which he has profound parallels with, then we see the oft-repeated clash between indigenous and proto-modern, modern cultures that has been playing out ever since the time of the Greeks. And we saw that moment of the opportunity for blessing for the individual Greek moderns leaving that indigenous sense of innate connection with the cosmos and going off on their experiment, which we're well embarked on, and a blessing on that path. But instead, what happened was a curse.
That's a very interesting. It really, really is. It was a major missed opportunity. And
it seems to be like one of those, the account in the Bible, you know, the Garden of Eden tale also has these deep resonances of the break with the primal mind, the exile, the sense of being cursed. Of course, Odysseus eventually finds his way home again, and he even makes, after having to go to the land of the dead, and he makes these final offerings to Poseidon in order to pass away in peace. So he actually does go and make some significant restitution as an individual. But I see a mythogem, a cultural teaching coming from way back about the emerging two minds of humanity, what different authors have called the primal and modern. You pick your scholar.
Well, one question I had about that, and this comes up in this idea, you invoke the Eden myth, the notion that there's sort of a primal fall, and I think that a lot of people who are attracted to indigenous worldviews and see the limitations of the West, you know, can see that the whole Eden myth is really a fall from the indigenous mind, as you call it. But my impression is that, you know, looking all over the place, and certainly throughout, you know, northern and southern America, North and South America, that a lot of indigenous myths also have within them a kind of fall. Like there's still a golden age that's back there, and now things are a little trickier. Doesn't mean that it's a total. It's not the idea of sin. It's not the idea you're going to hell. Anything like that. But there is a sense that there's, at least my impression, that, you know, we're in a tricky situation, not necessarily a balance.
Yeah.
And that's one of those points where I wonder when I see that a too simplistic a divide between the Western mind that is cut off and is Cartesian and no longer, you know, here's the nature, and then the indigenous mind that is still at one with nature. I'm like, well, it's not exactly at one. It's just, you know, there's definitely improvement in many, many ways, but it's not the same thing as imagining that everything is kind of hunky-dory. And that
absolutely
is really
agreed.
Important. And you talk about that, but I don't think enough people. And I hear, so how
there's so much to discuss in the book. You know, it was, okay, how much do I cover here? But there is absolutely, in the traditions that I'm familiar with, there are also major setbacks and falls. But I think you can say, and I'm open to correction on this, that the indigenous ways allow for a way for us to get through, because the cosmos is sentient. We are not cut off from direct contact with Creator. There are things we can do. We can make ourselves transparent to the elements, which are sacred, and we can attune ourselves again. In other words, it's kind of like we're out of the Garden of Eden, but we can get back in there long enough to get things reset, whereas the Garden of Eden has a cherubim with a sword, a flaming sword, guarding the entrance.
Yeah.
The break is not total in the indigenous traditions I'm familiar with.
Yeah, I totally want to pick up on
this. I feel like part of the flaming sword that's separating us from that is our own minds. I mean, the problem is so deep, we even perceive the shamans, just like how Eric said we perceive nature. The shamans are now set apart outside of ourselves, just like we set apart nature outside of ourselves. So we now, like in the West, are, like Eric said, looking for this hope for the shamanic drugs and techniques to do it. But how is that ever going to be efficacious if we're continuing to set it outside of something we can do ourselves? Like, I feel like until we understand that the whole freaking point of being a shaman is, like you said, to come back into contact with source. And if we, in our conscious mindset, view only the, like, shaman or outsider or the indigenous as the mechanism to achieve that, we're even setting up a hierarchy between ourselves and that. And we'll never be able to get through that sword into the Garden of Eden until we can understand that the whole point of doing that is to understand that that's our inherent nature as primal beings. So we keep separating ourselves from it, so we just cut ourselves off, kind of, you know?
Yeah, and it could depend on how you take the myth. I mean, some people might want to walk into the sword. I don't know.
Right.
There's different levels that myth exists at, of course, you know. And
right.
One of them is where it becomes point-blank personal, and there's others where it operates as a kind of cultural background that you swim in without knowing you're in it.
Yeah, that's a really, really important distinction. I want to pick up a little bit more on the whole idea of the perceiving universe, which I think is real, or the sentient universe, which I think is totally key. But we got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dau. We're talking with Robert Tyndall. Am I saying that right?
Tyndall.
Yeah, and about the Shamanic Odyssey, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dau. We're here with Eric Davis, speaking with Robert Tyndall, and we're talking about shamanism and Homer and the Odyssey and all kinds of fun stuff. And before the break, you had mentioned the importance of recognition that there is a sentience in the universe, and a kind of, you know, driving consciousness. And of course, this is a big thing that I feel like a lot of people that approach shamanism are starting to kind of get it. But like you said, that is also prevalent in a lot of the older mythology. And I was just curious if you, through your work with this culture, if you personally engaged in some of the plant medicine or had an experience of that sentience, or was it something that was just kind of like described to you?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, you can't understand these things except from within. When we were first here in 2004, I accompanied my wife, who was doing her dissertation research on the healing powers of ícaros, which are the magic songs that are used in ayahuasca mm-hmm. ceremonies. And so we ended up, through a wonderful series of circumstances, connecting with a Ashaninkan curandero named Juan Flores, who has a healing center outside of Pucallpa called Mayantuyacu. And Juan is a much better known figure now, but at the time, Mayantuyacu was just starting. And we had a chance to go out and work with him pretty exclusively for about 6 months. And during that time, our work with him quickly turned into an apprenticeship, because you just can't understand this stuff looking at it from the outside.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of your kind of ideas about it, they're based directly on, you know, your experiences that you had of it as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you feel like...
And then there's the whole work of kind of grounding yourself into tradition, because you start out very wide-eyed. And there's actually a wonderful scene in the Odyssey, an exchange between Telemachus, who's just encountering the spirit realm, and Odysseus, where Telemachus blurts out his awe and the wonder that he's seeing when Athena goes before them into their hall. And Odysseus just tells him to shut up and go to bed.
No,
there's some old hands at this business that are teaching in the world, and to find them is such an amazing privilege. There is so much to learn from these old timers, and so you know, when you start, it's you think you're Neo, kind of awoken from the Matrix or something. But after some years, things begin to settle out and you begin to see the different hierarchies of things and get a sense of humor and a sense of irony, and it begins to make more sense. But you need to go around confirming a lot of things and doing a lot of study as well.
One of the things I really liked is your description of that element. And in a way, you were actually kind of drawing a connection between elements of Odysseus and this your experience of some of the shamans you've worked with, especially the older, wiser hands, where that the visionary element of things goes hand in hand with a very pragmatic, grounded, open-ended, inquiring, humorous way of approaching the world that is, not the kind of thing that we think of if you think about somebody who's like, you know, duped by supernatural ideas. I mean, it's a very grounded, almost kind of modern sensibility where there is this commitment to inquiry, but it's an inquiry that's in a world that is sentient. It's a world that has the possibility of communication on many levels in all directions. And it's almost less about the character. This is probably what I'm thinking about. It's less about the character, meaning like the shaman is an entirely different kind of person who's, you know, blessed with all the healing energies of the planet, and we are over here like nothing because we just have comic books and smartphones. But it's actually the people aren't necessarily that different. It's the world they're in. It's a world that that's not written in stone. Like this world of nature is separate from humans, and humans are the one that have agency. And there's no sentience in nature. There's no animation in nature. That's a construct that too can be eroded in this sort of postmodern process that's in modernity itself. So it seems like there's kind of an opening in what you're kind of telling us about this sort of wiser element of the shaman, is that it's not the romantic dream, that there is this elements that we find core in our own value system, including things we like about Odysseus, that he is kind of, that he is canny, that he does have his feet on the ground, that he does have certain practical material goals that he wants to use his cleverness in order to manifest. It's just that the worldview and the goals are so different in so many ways. So I think you've done a good job of, again, like breaking down the overly black and white picture of things. But I want to hear from you, because you talk about the indigenous mind and you talk about the world, the forest that speaks, that is relational, that has sentience. And obviously, inside ceremony and inside the deep work of the space, there's all sorts of magic and enchantment going on. But I'm kind of curious, almost on a more ordinary level, how your own mind has kind of become more indigenous, if you will, although it's sort of loaded way to put it, but that your own mind has kind of gone through transformations in terms of how you relate to the world, how you see nature, how you see other animals, how you see the weather. Because you've been, you've been doing this for a while now.
Well, I wish I could tell you I'm some great enlightened figure that walks around able to talk to trees, but it wouldn't be true. I think that the main thing that I've gotten out of this work, and I wasn't even familiar with the term animism intimately until I finished writing the book. I was working through a lot of things while I was writing within a particular area of endeavor, but I'm not an expert really in any of it. I have a master's in literature, and I like to tell stories. And so that was the origin of all of this. And I don't set myself up as a healer either, but I do not mind claiming an apprentice status. And it's a very difficult question to answer, how have I changed? I mean, certainly my relationships with my family and with my culture have undergone radical revisions. I'm no longer in danger of being an alcoholic. There has been a sense of opening to a whole source of inspiration that I didn't have access to before. And there's a feeling of luck, of blessing being more present in my life now. But I also think that we're you know, as before I came on this program, I was listening to what the radio was saying about the repercussions of the bombing in Boston and you know, the present very naked power moves of the U.S. government to seize more and more control over people's rights. And we're in a time of real difficulty. And, you know, the elders that we work with, both in the North and the South, are really clear that this isn't about a peaceful ride. And this is actually a time where every ounce of your resources is going to be needed to carry forward a living culture within this society. And so I don't actually track myself in terms of, you know, how much symbiosis with nature do I have. I notice a lot more of it. But I think that my main attention is on raising my child, who's 3 and a half right now, in a good way, and taking the right steps to preserve a viable human culture and preserving the shamanic tradition, because I think this kind of knowledge is at the heart of what's going to carry forward the preservation of natural systems on the planet, because otherwise we're going to devour them.
Well, it's interesting to me, like, just the importance and significance of the whole addiction thing. Like, so, I mean, part of the thing you were involved with was looking at the treatment of it for specific addictions. And if you kind of break it down, like, from conversations I've had with my shamans that I have met, they view addiction as, like, you know, it's the siren song, it's the possession, like you're no longer driving, right? You get taken over by something to the point that, like, you would dive off a ship, you'll do something destructive, you would sacrifice your body, like, or whatever, like, you would, it's destructive and consumptive, right? Like, when we're under the influence of some addictive thing, the compulsion and drive to fill the desire is so strong, you know, you'll sacrifice your child, you'll sacrifice your physical well-being. It's insane. You don't even, like, you can't think about it because something else is driving. So with this kind of cures for addiction, the shamanic method sees it as, like you said, like removing the influence of that entity, like whether it's a siren song,
absolutely,
or if it's alcohol, or if it's a plant, or if it's whatever.
Yep.
So that mindset specifically for addiction, I feel like, is what, you know, is driving most of the destructive behavior that's occurring. You
absolutely
know?
May I share one story?
Oh, please do.
It's a quick one. I had a very deep affection with red wine for many years. It was this mellow cave I would go into after a hard day of work. And in one ceremony with a Shipibo shaman, they have very interesting ikaros. They're just completely unique. They're very Asiatic sounding, and I was praying to water, actually, for the health of the water of the world, and I became aware of something dark over my shoulder. But it was just a quick glimpse, and before I knew it, my hand had whipped up and grabbed whatever it was and shoved it in my water bottle. Like a cat, you know. And I sat there in the midst of the ceremony saying, okay, all right, I just grabbed the spirit and shoved it in my water bottle. Now what do I do? So then I'm told, okay, go outside, scatter the water, release it to the elements. So I get up and I make my way out. I get outside beneath the stars, and give the water back. Go back in, I sit down, and I'm kind of like, okay, so what was that about? And pretty soon the answer formed, and that had been a spirit of alcohol, which had been working through my addiction to red wine and was feeding off of my energy. And it was so total, the recognition, that I went home and I took every bottle of red wine out of the house and took it back to Trader Joe's. It was a really good organic red wine. It was like, bye-bye. And I haven't even wanted to taste red wine since. And my mouth used to water when I saw someone drinking red wine, and I was not drinking. It just was excised. And, boy, this is really good stuff.
It is. It's exorcism. It's exorcism. It's exactly what it is.
It is. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's one of those things. That's a really good example of how, even if we're not visiting the jungle and we're not sitting at the feet of you know, wise masters, even in just our ordinary, you know, mucky Western lives, the difference between having that relational idea, that animist idea that things out there have their own little spirit, their own little personality, can fool us. Because if I think that only it's just me in the room, it's me and the bottle of wine, nobody else is around. If I'm just like, I'm the only one who's an agent in this room, I'm the only one who has choice in this room, I'm the only one who has personality, then I'm just going to choose to have my glass of wine. You know, it's just me. I'm doing that. When, of course, what's going on, the red wine is like, I'm red wine, I'm pretty good, I'm good, the right place at the right time, it's pretty great, a lot of religion comes out of me, can't knock red wine from a, you know, it's not like heroin or something, you know, it has its own story. And so that when I develop that relationship, it is a relationship. And the same way that you go, God, I don't know if hanging out with those people is exactly that great for me, or, you know, there's a conflict between my parents and this my friend, and, you know, that it's such a different way of moving through your ordinary life, even your technologies, your car. There are little elements of these relationships going on all the time, and I think it's just better if you think that way. At least some of the time, it's actually just, it's just clearer, let alone being
more
fun.
That's the problem with the sentient universe, is that everything is sentient, and you're relating to it, like you said, like a relationship with your friends. And that's true from when you extend it to everything and you start to see those implications, it's a little overwhelming, and it's kind of a holy moly, but then it changes your behavior. And like you said, with the realization, you become more sentient yourself. You know, because you're not driven as much by the other, whatever.
Well, and the other side, this is someone else. I was reading one of these anthropologists that I really really liked, and he was talking about one of the criticisms about the Western mind that he was saying is that we have this model, which has its good side, but we nonetheless have this model of like liberation, where the idea is to free yourself, freedom, to be deep, you know, to be unattached from things that hold you down. And that's a very powerful idea. We all have it still, and there's obviously positive things about it. That's why it's so powerful. But what he says, the problem with that is that we distort and ignore through that myth the way in which we are always, always embedded in relationship. And so it's never just about, I need to free myself from this relationship. It's, you know, actually, if I make that other relationship, that older relationship that I'm not really, it's not really working for me, will be easier to get out of. So it's more like you shift your relation rather than just liberate yourself from some situation where you're stuck. And that's a really different way of thinking about it. And I think that, and it sounded like from what you were saying, Robert, that that's part of what you're seeing with this addiction work, is that it's precisely because it's not just like you are an individual who's going to free yourself from this terrible addiction thing. It's like, no, there's a spiritual world you're moving in where there's relationships with different entities, and new relationships can come in and change the old relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, you get, you become a more relational being in that way. You know, I'm sitting here smoking the tobacco of the Amazon, which I usually don't smoke. I'm not a nicotine addict. I don't have Mapachos or Marlboros in my pocket. I smoke Amazonian tobacco, which is used for healing, but it's also used for prayer. And so when I really want to open up a means of communication and fluidity and focus for myself, I'll sit with a Mapacho and use it in its traditional way. This makes me more permeable. Yeah, it's this way that instead of tobacco being an addiction that like releases tension for me or whatever, I mean, you know, tobacco addicts have going on. Instead, it's something that I can use to be relational. Because I have dieted tobacco in the jungle for a month. And I have dreamt of the tobacco spirit. And I've written about him. And in the book, I actually mentioned, for those who know something about tobacco, that his spirit is very similar to Hermes.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, as I'm smoking this Mapacho, I'm watching the smoke go up and disperse to space, to heaven, and I'm tuning myself in a particular way. I'm really, really grateful to tobacco. It's helped me a great, great deal.
Mm-hmm.
I know
it
as a being
came
now.
You came into a conscious relationship with it, and that's different, you know?
That's what you learn about how to work with plants down here.
I mean, and that's the main shamanic thing, is any addiction or substance or eating or whatever, it's only comes down to how are you consciously dealing with the thing, you know? And even what, and that's like the same thing that Buddha and the yogis have said, like it doesn't matter what goes in and out of your mouth, it's what, you know, comes out of your heart, as Jesus said, that is what makes a thing pure or impure, you know? But if people can't change that consciousness, then they'll continue to just get addicted, or they'll go do they can do the same thing with ayahuasca. Ayahuasca will be as addictive to people as, you know, whatever, because they'll look to it to solve the problem, and they're like then handing all the power over to the plant and becoming possessed by the ayahuasca, just as if they're becoming possessed by red wine.
I don't actually think that is so likely.
No?
No, I was thinking about this a little earlier. There are people far better at discussing this kind of thing than I am. But I think that plants such as ayahuasca, peyote, have a fundamentally pedagogical and open, sentient presence. When you drink ayahuasca and you come into intimacy with the plant, it comes in and works on you. And there's in one sense you surf it, in other ways you direct it. Sometimes it just comes in and heals you. You know, there's something you got to deal with, and it does the job. But there's always a feeling of like, of not of that cozy little cave to withdraw into. It's kind of like, you know, trying to get addicted to a grizzly bear or something. It could be a little dangerous, you know. And, you know, they really are, for indigenous people, and I find I tend to share indigenous views pretty consistently. These plants are sacred beings. They have immense knowledge. And even if your motivation isn't so hot, and how many of us have good motivations, even when we sit down to pray or meditate? I mean, we're always getting ourselves attuned. If you know, if your heart's in the right place, I don't see how ayahuasca could be addictive.
You know, we're going to have to leave it.
If your heart's not in the right place, you're going to have a hard time getting addicted to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there, Robert. Thanks so much for being with us on Expanding Mind.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me.
And Robert's
really
book is The Shamanic Odyssey, Homer, Tolkien, and the Visionary Experience. From me and Maja here at PRN, keep your minds open.